Okay, so Roger and Kurt has already introduced the subject of circumcell interaction. So in this talk, I would like to talk about two particular aspects of this, which I think is relevant both to TRBs and to supernova remnant. And the first part of the talk will mainly deal with radio and X-ray observations of one of the best observed cases of circumstellar interaction, supernova 1993A, and the implications and what we can learn about things like particle acceleration and shock physics in general in this case. And I think this is a very good analog of non-relativistic analog of a GRB. And then in the second part, I will discuss some new observations and modeling of supernova 1987A, which I also think is quite relevant for, well, in particular for supernova remnants. As I said, 1983A is one of the best cases for circumstellar interaction and by far the best observed one, possibly now challenged by 87A with the ring collision. And Kurt has already shown some of these very nice VLA observations, a very complete set of observations, which shows this characteristic turn on, which is wavelength dependent, first short wavelengths and then longer. Then the optically thin phase, which is basically showing a power law synchrotron spectrum. What makes this supernova particularly interesting is the fact that this was so strong and so close in M81 that one could also make VLBI observations. And there's a very or actually two very nice sets of observations by Battelle et al. And Marcady et al., which shows the evolution of the this radio-emitting shell. And it's very interesting that this is actually fairly uniform spherical shell, in spite of the fact that in this case it's thought to be the result of the explosion in a binary system. This was also observed in the optical, of course, and it started off as a type 2 supernova. But then, after some time, the H-alpha line disappeared and it transformed itself into type 1b supernova. So usually this is designated as a type 2b. After about a year, the H-alpha came back, but then with a line profile which was very flat, which is characteristic of a thin emitting shell, which is with velocity which is quite similar to that inferred from the radio observations. And you have already seen this picture, and I'll just repeat it very quickly, that you have the supernova ejecta expanding out into the circumstellar medium of the progenitor. This will give rise to a very fast blast wave with very high temperature, 10 to 9 degrees behind. And the pressure from this will then drive a reverse shock into the supernova ejecta. But because of the steep density gradient, the velocity of this reverse shock will be much lower. And the temperature only about 10 to the 7 degrees. That means that this circumstellar shock, that will be cooling, and you will form a very thin and dense cool shell between the reverse shock and the blast wave. And this has important observation consequences, as I will come back to. And Roger showed some very nice simulations, and this is just a frame from a similar kind of simulations by Chevalier and Blondin, which shows this structure with the reverse shock here and this thin, dense layer, which is relatively unstable, the contact discontinuity between the reverse shock and the shocked circumstellar medium. And then we have the blast wave up here. This is covering most of the region, and this is where most likely the radio emission is coming, whereas most of the X-rays are coming from this region. The observations were kind of interesting because at the early time it showed a very hard spectrum. But then after a few months it transformed the spectrum into a very soft one with a KT of about 1 keV. And this transition I think can be quite nicely explained as a consequence of this cool dense shell between the reverse shock and the blast wave, because the X-ray luminosity is really dominated by the reverse shock. But because of the high column density of this region, at the early stages, most of these soft X-rays will be absorbed by this thin shell. So at early time, the X-ray emission will be dominated by the blast wave here. That's will give a very hard, hot, pre-free spectrum. But then, as the supernova is expanding, then the soft X-rays from the reverse shock will gradually penetrate this shell. And at some point, you will see the high energy part of the emission from this reverse shock. And that will then dominate the emission, and that's got a temperature of the order of a few keV. So this sort of picture, I think, is quite consistent with the observations. And it's important to remember that in most cases, at later stages, the X-ray emission will be dominated by the reverse shock. And there's been subsequently more observations, X-ray observations, which shows different lines, the line spectrum. This is taken at several years after the explosion in April 2001. And that's been claims for enhanced silicon abundances, and also for other supernovas, that's been claims for enhanced elements, which could be due to processed material. But I think one should realize that most of this most of this has been claimed on the basis of one or two temperature fits. And in fact, because you have a cooling shock, you have very large range of temperatures contributing to the X-ray spectrum. That means that the spectrum will not at all look like that you get for one or two temperatures. Here's just an example where the red line is showing the temperature for a constant temperature spectrum, whereas the black line is showing the X-ray spectrum from a cooling shock like this one, a more realistic case. And as you see, that's very big differences in the line strengths, and making an abundance analysis based on a one temperature assumption would give extremely suspicious results in this case. I will not say very much about the optical emission, just say that it's really consistent with having these X-rays, which are absorbed by the circumstellar ejecta, reprocessed into the optical and UV emission. Instead, I would say talk a bit more about the radio emission, because I think that's where we can learn something interesting. And Kurt has already been discussing these two different mechanisms, pre-free absorption and synchrotron self-absorption. The pre-free absorption by the external circumstellar medium, that's interesting because from the time of the optical depth unity, you can derive the mass loss rate, or rather the mass loss rate divided by the wind velocity. Unfortunately, that is dependent on what you assume about the circumstellar temperature of the gas. And it's not at all obvious what kind of number one should put in here. There's been some calculations by Peter Lundqvist which shows that you actually, because of the heating of the circumstellar medium by the X and UV flash, at the outbreak, you will get a very high temperature of the order of 100,000 degrees. But this does matter from case to case, depending on what kind of supernova you have and so on. For some of these stronger X-ray radio sources, 79C, 80K, these type 2L supernovae, one could in this way derive mass loss rate of the order of 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year if one assumes a wind velocity of 10 kilometers per second. And this strongly indicates that this mass loss phase cannot be a very long one. It has to be something like a super wind or something like that. And that could be relevant to the creation of various shells and things like that, which Roger was referring to. And recently, we heard that there's been some observations of type 2 P's, ordinary type plateau type supernovae, the most common ones. And that's interesting because they're really the sort of standard, most common objects, the common supernova we have. And the radio observations by Stockdale and Beswick and Argo and others, by Merlin and VLA, implies mass loss rate of the order of a few times 10 to the minus 6, or perhaps 10 up to 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year for this kind of temperature. This is quite typical of what you expect for ordinary red supergiants in our galaxy. So I think for these type 2 pieces, they don't offer any big surprises. Synchronous self-absorption is interesting because that offers us really a possibility to understand something about the magnetic field and particle acceleration. And Roger has already been discussing this, and we'll just point out that in the same way as for gamma ray bursts, one can, from the time of optical depth unity for the synchrotron self-absorption and from the flux, if one knows the size of the emitting region, one can then derive the magnetic field and the number of relativistic electrons. This is, of course, something which is interesting. You want to understand the acceleration mechanism, for example. Unfortunately, this does depend on that you really know the size of this emitting region. And that's not always the case, in particular for, well, for GABs it's a problem, and also for type 1C supernovae, it's not obvious how you get this number. 93A was, we are very fortunate because we have the VLBI observations, which gives directly the diameter of the emitting region, and also its evolution with time, as you see from these VLBI observations by Bartel et al. And you can also get the size of the region directly from the line widths, and these two different ways of estimating the emitting region is quite consistent with each other. And that means that for each epoch, for each radio observation, you can actually fit this, the observed spectrum with this synchrotron self-absorption, and possibly also a combination with the free-free external absorption to the observations. And then for each day you can derive then what the magnetic field and particle density is as a function of time. A93A is kind of the borderline case between free-free and synchrotron self-absorption. Free-free absorption is contributing, especially at low frequency and at early times. And that's quite fortunate because then you can also derive the mass loss rate, which you can't do from the synchrotron self-absorption model directly. And this is quite consistent with what you get, for example, from the X-rays. Perhaps more interesting is the fact that we can then measure what the magnetic field is as a function of time, and also the relativistic particle density. And what you see is that the magnetic field is very strong. It's of the order of tens of Gauss initially, and then decaying roughly as 1 over the time, or 1 over the radius. The relativistic particle density, that's going down basically proportion to the energy density, 1 over t squared. And these very high magnetic field magnetic fields, which you see here, they are much higher than what you get just from a compressed wind field. And it clearly shows that you need magnetic field amplification at the shock, possibly by some kind of plasma instability. The magnetic field you get, if you translate this to the usual kind of epsilon parameters, this is quite close to equipotential, about 50%. However, the density of relativistic electrons is very low, 10 to the minus 4 or something like that. So this is, the electrons are far from equipotential, but the magnetic field is in this case. One can turn this game around and just assume that you have constant epsilon b's and epsilon e's, and then include all kind of cooling processes, the Compton synchrotron cooling, Coulomb cooling, which contributes also, and do the radiative transfer and calculate a consistent electron spectrum, and then produce theoretical light curves which can directly be compared to the observations. And that's what you is shown in this figure here, which shows that you can get very good agreement between the observations and the model with this very simple sort of assumption. So this gives some sort of confidence that these epsilon b's and epsilon e's really are constant as a supernova is evolving. And I think this is something which might be interesting for in many contexts. This model was predicting that at late time, well, there should be a cooling break. Synchrotron cooling is important during most of this evolution. And for that reason, it was very interesting that with the GMRT and VLA, at an age of about 3,400 days, there was really a cooling break observed at roughly the frequency which was predicted by this modeling here. So this gives some, well, has some sort of predictive power, this kind of model, which is sometimes nice. This is just summarizing the modeling here. And there's been quite a lot of controversy whether the circumstellar medium is really not to the minus 2 or something flatter. There's been claims for that, both from X-rays and radio. And I don't think there's any observations from any self-consistent modeling that the circumstellar medium, in this case, is anything different from not to the minus 2. I mean, it could be at larger radii at later stages, but as far as these observations are concerned, there's no evidence, I think. I've already discussed these points here. The injection spectrum right at the shock, that's consistent with the power law to the minus 2. And then, of course, cooling process will change this power law, but the injection spectrum should be something fairly close to this one, which is, well, basically what one might expect, at least in the most simple first-order Fermi acceleration models. I just mentioned this fact that the epsilon e is very small, but if one, I think it's interesting to note that if one just assumes that you have the same number of relativistic protons as you have electrons, then actually the energy fraction in the protons in the cosmic rays will be fairly close to the competition, which I think could have some sort of significance. I will probably skip a bit of this thing about signal diagnostic, but just mention that there's an independent evidence for this mass loss from the fact that one with HST can observe a number of strong UV lines. In particular, they're very strong nitrogen lines, much stronger than the carbon lines. That's exactly what you expect to see if you have CNO processing, which is in combination with mass loss and mixing. And this has been observed for a very large number of supernovae now, and this can give some extra information to the mass loss process in these progenitors of these supernovae. And instead, I will come to a completely different thing, and that's 87A and the ring collision. 87A had an obvious circumstellar medium as soon as a few years after it was observed. It was discovered that it had this very nice ring around it, which was lit up by the UV flash in connection with the explosion. Then after that, it has cooled and recombined. But then in the end of the 90s, one was discovering that there were some points, in particular one spot here, which was becoming brighter and brighter. And then subsequently, there was more and more points like that. And today, nearly the whole ring is lit up by this interaction. And at the same time, you also see that the supernova is expanding. It's obvious that it's the supernova which is now hitting the ring. You don't see the very high velocity parts of the ejecta. It's expanding with up to 30,000 kilometers per second. But that's now what is interacting with the ring. And the origin of these rings, I think, is still somewhat unclear. I think, at least to me, the best bet is probably that they were produced as a result of emerging process in connection, a few tens of thousand years before the explosion. And Phil has done some quite nice modeling here, and there are some interesting support for this from, for example, this nitrogen-carbon ratio. This is something which could possibly be also relevant to shells around type 1c progenitors, for example. They could have similar sort of structures. These rings have not only been bright in the optical and UV, but also in the X-rays. They have been observed with Chandra and also with the Australia Telescope Compact Array. And in all cases, they have an increasing flux. And the radio and hard X-rays correlate quite well with each other, whereas the soft X-rays are increasing in strength much faster than the hard X-rays and radio. And this also the optical is following this quite well. I think it's interesting that one can also observe this structure and this emission also from ground. And we have got some observations with the Symphony instrument. This is an adaptive optics integral field unit in the for the near infrared. And this is an image in the helium line at one particular wavelength. And unfortunately, I couldn't get the movie working, but one can basically scan through the whole line and get images for each wavelength in this way. And in this way, one can really map the dynamics of the ring at these different, at all the different positions around the ring. And that's something which is interesting to understand, for understanding the hydrodynamics of this interaction. And here you can see how the velocity of these various spots is varying along the ring. There's also been some mid-infrared, recent mid-infrared observations, and it's both from the ground with the Gemini South and also by Spitzer, and in both cases one finds very strong evidence for heated dust. Okay. And with a temperature of the order of 160 degrees, and there's also very clear silicon features, so it clearly shows that that the dust close to the ring is now beginning to be heated, either by collisions or possibly by the X-rays which are produced in this interaction. The hydrodynamics of this interaction is very complex, and well, actually, before most of these things happened, there were some very nice simulations by well, Borkowski and Michael and John Blondin and others, which clearly showed these different aspects of this. And from this cartoon, you can see the main features of this, where you have, well, first the blast wave, which is expanding first into an H2 region inside the ring, and that will create the reverse shock here. But then when this blast wave is hitting the first protrusions from the ring, that will send a shockwave into these dense spots, and because the density here is a factor of 100 or 1,000 higher than the surrounding, then this shockwave will be much slower than the blast wave here. And that means that, well, the shock velocities here will be of the order of, well, 500 kilometers or perhaps a bit higher. And these shocks, they will be quite dense and slow, and therefore they will be radiative in most cases. And this is where most of this optical emission, which is observed, is seen, and also some of the X-rays. This reverse shock will have a much higher velocity, and it's most likely that the radio emission and the hard X-rays that is produced in this region. And here you can see, but the whole thing is very complex with reflected shocks, and gradually these spots and this ring will then be eaten up by the propagating blast wave when it's passing through. But time scale for that is quite unknown. It of course depends on the extent of this region. The dynamics of this can be observed, and I will just mention some observations here of the reverse shock, which shows this is the H-alpha line extending out to about 15,000 kilometers per second, which is close to what you expect for the ejecta at the reverse shock. And Then on top of that, you have also a number of narrow lines. These are coming from the unshocked ring and also the shocked ring material. These are the semi-broad ones, whereas the very narrow lines, like this one, for example, they're coming from the unshocked ring. And here we have some observations also from the VLT of some of this shocked line. These are lines coming from gas which has been shocked in these protrusions, has cooled down from a few million degrees down to about 10,000 degrees. That's what you can see here. And this applies from the line width. You can directly see what sort of velocities you have here. It's of the order of 200 or 300 kilometers per second. What's especially interesting about these optical observations is the fact that you see a number of high ionization lines, and in particular you see this famous IN14 coronal line at 53 or 3 angström. And the fact that you do see this line also together with these others, that tells you directly that this emission, which has the same line profile as the lower ionization lines, is really coming from very hot gas, which is then cooling down very rapidly to low temperatures. And this is quite complementary to what you see in the X-rays. And there's been some very nice observations with Chandra, by Chekhov et al., and well, also previous observations, which shows a very rich X-ray spectrum, also from high ionization stages like IN17. So you see somewhat higher ionization stages than you see in the optical. But and then you also see some helium and hydrogen-like lines of various heavy elements. And these X-ray observations, together with the optical observations, sorry? Oh, that's, I think it's from the first order spectrum or something like that. It's, you can just ignore it, I think, for this purpose. Sorry? Yeah, so I think you can forget about it right now. It's really these narrow lines which are important, and from these you can also get an estimate of the line widths. And so I'm combining the X-ray observations with these optical observations, one can really trace the evolution of this shocked gas from when it's shocked at the temperature of several million degrees down all the way as it's cooling here. And I think this is a quite nice shock diagnostic of these. And so I just summarize some of these things, that while mass loss is very important for both the X-rays, radio, and also the late optical emission, and it's a very important diagnostic of this, and it is becoming increasingly important as you go from the type 2Ps, which show fairly mild indications of mass loss, to the type 2Ls, type 2Ns, and then going up to the type 1Bs and Cs. And what I think is perhaps especially interesting for this meeting is the fact that we do have, especially from 93A, very strong evidence for magnetic field amplification up to the coefficient value. But the density of relativistic electrons is quite a bit lower, and the question is how much cosmic rays are contributing to the energy in this case. And finally, I hope I've shown that 87 is a very interesting laboratory for shock physics and to study both thermal and non-thermal processes. And I think in the future, when the last wave is really hitting the whole, most of the ring, then we'll see even more of this. So that's it. Thank you.
Gray is not here to also say something about 1987, but he had to go home.
Yeah.
Dr. Kumar.
Maybe in one, was it just one case where epsilon E was 10 to the power minus 4?
It's I mean, we basically have only one case where you can really make a believable analysis.
Sure.
I mean, there are arguments why it could be for other cases where it could be larger, but I mean, this is by far the best case, and it is a bit surprising it's so low, but I mean, it could be.
That was my next question, which is the following. Since you are making a measurement here of epsilon E in the radio band, electrons, which are relativistic electrons, are only contributing to the emission. My question is that the way that you define epsilon E, I guess, is that it is the fraction of energy in electrons which are relativistic emitting radio at radio wavelength band. So which means that there could well be a population of electrons which are sub-relativistic or relativistic but mildly, relativistic but radiating below your energy band.
Yeah, and also at higher energies.
That's right. And so, for instance, if you were to do the counting of including all the electrons, possibly epsilon E would not be so small.
No, I mean, that's that's very true. And but the thing is that because the magnetic field is so strong, the electrons which are observed in the radio band, that's actually has very low gammas, down to, well, initially down to 10 or something like that. So at the low energy end, I don't think you miss too much, really. But it is true that this is just the part of the spectrum which is directly observed, which is contributing here. But well, I'm not sure. I would be surprised if you can gain much more than a factor of 10 or something like that by counting anything else. So, I mean, it wouldn't change things very much. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm. I mean, you have to inject them in some way, but no, of course you have the thermal population.
Klaus? So yeah, I mean, you know, a few years ago we had also tried to model the light curves of 93J, and we got the same results. Like with epsilon E has to be like around 10^-4, and the surrounding temperature has to be at least 70,000, but probably higher. Just like you got. But the one thing was that, you know, we found that S is not equal to 2 purely because we tried to fit the exact sort of expansion that Bartel et al. Showed, where they say it goes as T to the 0.9 something earlier and then T to the 0.75 later or something. And that can't be fit with S equal to 2. So do you think that that's not believable, or do you just think it's a...
You mean that your results are not believable?
Pardon?
You mean that your results are not believable, or what do you mean?
No, that the expansion that we see, that they measure is T to the 0.9 and then T to the 0.75, I mean, that can't be fit with S equal to 2.
That was actually exactly what we did. I mean, we did put in Bartels their expansion measurements. And we did not do any assumption or any modeling. We just put in what the observations from the DLBI was telling us.
So how does it slow it down then with S equal to 2? I'm not sure. Or like, you know, as I said, the expansion is decelerating over time. Like it goes...
It's decelerating. I mean, that's set by the density gradient in the ejector.
Yeah, and we had to start to actually change it to get the right deceleration. That's what I'm saying.
No, so I mean, it can tell something about the ejector structure, but probably not about the circumstellar medium.
Okay, well, we can talk.
Other comments or questions?
The emission from the ring of 93J looks very clumpy, dominated by, was it two or three bright spots? 93J in the VLBI observations. I just wondered, have you looked at the sensitivity of your computation of the magnetic field to the filling factor of the ring or something like that?
No, we did not include anything like that. It's so this is what John is referring to, and we did not include anything like that. I think the variations here is of the order of 20% or something like that. So it's not an enormous factor actually. I think the color coding might be somewhat misleading.
Other comments or questions? If not, then let's thank Klaas again.